Hello and welcome to the first episode of our brand new season of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales. Welcome back. If you're a returning listener, it's great to have you back. And if you're a new listener who enjoys the stories over the festive break and is interested in some more, then it's lovely to have you here. As previously, first we'll hear the story, then some information about the folklore behind the fairy tale. Then we'll hear some more about the food and some of its history and how it connects to the story itself. Our story today is The Two Little Pizzas from Stories of the Pentamerone or Tale of Tales. My version is adapted from the translation of John Taylor from 1847. Some of the language is a little archaic, but I think it'll take you to another place, which is what I think a lot of us need at the moment. The original stories are written by Giambattista Basile and were written in the Neapolitan dialect. Well, gentle listener, if you're ready and relaxed, I'll begin. I have always heard say that he who gives pleasure finds it. The bell of Manfredonia says, "Give to me, I give to you." He does not bait the hook of the affections with courtesy, never catches the fish of kindness. And if you wish to hear proof of this, listen to my story, and say whether the greedy man doesn't lose more than the generous one. There were once two sisters, named Lucita and Troccola, who had two daughters, Marziella and Puccia. Marziella was good at heart, whilst on the contrary, Puccia had a heart of pestilence. But the girl resembled her parent, for Troccola was a harpy within. Now it happened that Lucita had occasion to boil some parsnips in order to fry them with green sauce. So she said to her daughter, "Marziella, my dear, go to the well and fetch me a pitcher of water." "With all my heart, mother," replied the girl, "but if you love me, give me a little pizza, for shall I like to eat it with a draught of the fresh water?" "By all means," said the mother. So she took from a basket that hung upon a hook a beautiful pizza, for she had baked bread the day before, and gave it to Marziella, who set the pitcher on a pad on her head and went to the fountain, which, like a charlatan and marble bench, to the music of falling water, said selling secrets to drive away thirst. And as she was stooping down to fill up her pitcher, up came a humpback old woman, and seeing the beautiful pizza, which Marziella was just going to bite into, said to her, "My pretty, give me a piece of your pizza, and may heaven send you good fortune." Marziella, who was as generous as a queen, cried, "Take it all, my good woman. I'm only sorry it's not a cake of sugar and almonds, for I'd equally give it to you with all my heart." The old woman, seeing Marziella's kindness, said to her, "Go, and may heaven reward you for the goodness you've shown me. And I pray all the stars that you may ever be content and happy, and that when you breathe, roses and jessamines will fall from your mouth. And when you comb your hair, pearls and garnets may fall from them. And when you set your foot on the ground, violets and lilies will spring up." Marziella thanked the old woman and went her way home, where her mother, having cooked a bit of supper, they both ate up and ended the day. And the next morning, when the sun displayed in the marketplace of celestial fields the merchandise of light which he had bought from the east, as Marziella was combing her hair, she saw a shower of pearls and garnets fall from it into her lap, whereupon her mother with great joy put them all in a basket, and Lucita went out to sell a great part of them to the moneylender, who was a friend of hers. Meanwhile, Troccola came to see her sister, and finding Marziella in great delight and busied with the pearls, asked her how, when, and where she had gotten them. But the maiden, who did not understand the ways of the world, and had perhaps never heard the proverb, "Do not all you are able, eat not all you wish, spend not all you have, and tell not all you know," related the whole affair to her aunt, who no longer cared to wait for her sister's return, for every hour seemed a thousand years until she got home again. Then, giving a little pizza to her daughter, she sent her water to the fountain, where Puccia found the same old woman. And when the old woman asked her for a little piece of pizza, she answered gruffly, "Have I nothing to do but to give you pizza? Do you take me as foolish as to give you what belongs to me? Look, charity begins at home." And so saying, she swallowed the pizza in four pieces, making the old woman's mouth water, who, when she saw the last morsel disappear and her hopes buried with the pizza, exclaimed in rage, "Begone! Whatever you breathe, may you foam at the mouth like a doctor's mule. May toads drop from your lips. And every time you set foot on the ground, may there spring up ferns and thistles." Pooja took the pitcher of water and returned home, where her mother was all impatience to hear what had befallen her at the fountain. But no sooner did Pooja open her lips than a shower of toads fell from them, at which sight her mother added the fire of rage to the snow of envy, sending forth flame and smoke through her nose and mouth. Now it happened some time afterwards that Kiyomo, the brother of Matsuyala, was at the court of King of Kijunso, and the conversation turned on the beauty of various women. He stepped forward unasked and said that all handsome women might hide their heads when his sister made her appearance, who, beside the beauty of her form and her wonderful harmony of the song of a noble soul, possessed also a wonderful virtue in her hair, mouth and feet, which was given to her by a fairy. When the king heard these praises, he told Kiyomo to bring his sister to court, adding that if he found her such as he had represented, he would take her to wife. Now, Kiyomo thought this was a chance not to be lost, so he sent straight off a messenger to his mother, telling her what had happened and begging her to come instantly with her daughter, in order not to let slip the good luck. But Lakita, who was very unwell, commending the lamb to the wolf, begged her sister to have the kindness to accompany Matsuyala to the court of Chunso for such and such a thing. Whereupon Trokola, who saw that matters were playing into her hand, promised her sister to take Matsuyala safe and sound to her brother, and then embarked with her niece and Pooja in a boat. But when they were some way out at sea, while the sailors were asleep, she threw poor Matsuyala into the water, and just as she was on the point of being drowned, there came the most beautiful mermaid, who took her in her arms and carried her off. When Trokola arrived at Chunso, Kiyomo, who had not seen his sister for such a long time, mistook Pooja, and received her as if she were Matsuyala, and led her instantly to the king. But no sooner did she open her lips than toads dropped from the ground, and when the king looked at her more closely, he saw, as she breathed hard from the fatigue of the journey, that she made her mouth a lather, which looked like a wash basin. Then, looking down on the ground, he saw a meadow of stinking plants, the sight of which made him quite ill. Upon this, he drove Pooja and her mother away, and sent Kiyomo in disgrace to keep the ducks of the court. Then Kiyomo, in despair, and not knowing what had happened to him, drove the ducks into the fields, letting them go their way along the seashore. He used to retire into a little straw shed, where he bewailed his lots until the evening, when it was time to return home. But while the ducks were running about on the shore, Matsuyala would come out of the water and feed them with much pain, and give them rose water to drink, so that the ducks grew big as sheep, and were so fat that they couldn't see out from their eyes. And in the evening they came into a little garden under the king's window and began to sing. Pire, 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 the sun and the moon are bright and clear, but she who feeds us is still more fair. Now the king, hearing this duck music every evening, ordered Kiyomo to be called, and asked him where and how, and upon what he fed his ducks. And Kiyomo said, "I give them nothing to eat but the fresh grass of the field." But the king, who was not satisfied with this answer, sent a trusty servant after Kiyomo to watch and observe where he drove the ducks. Then the man followed in his footsteps, and saw him go into the little straw shed, leaving the ducks to themselves, and going their way. They'd no sooner come to the shore than Matsuyala rose up out of the sea. And I don't think anyone has ever risen from the waves so fair. When the servant of the king saw this, he ran back to his master, beside himself with amazement, and told him the pretty spectacle he had seen upon the seashore. The curiosity of the king was increased by what the man told him, and he had a great desire to go himself and see the beautiful sight. So the next morning, when the cock, the ringleader of the birds, excited them all to arm mankind against the night, and Kiyomo went with the geese to the accustomed spot, the king followed him closely. And when the ducks came to the seashore, without Kiyomo, who remained as usual in the little shed, the king saw Matsuyala rise out of the water, and after giving the geese a trayful of marchpane to eat and a cupful of rosewater to drink, she seated herself on a rock and began to comb her hair, from which fell handfuls of pearls and garnets, and at the same time a cloud of flowers dropped from her mouth, and under her feet was a Syrian carpet of lilies and violets. When the king saw this sight, he ordered Kiyomo to be called, and pointing to Matsuyala, asked him whether he knew that beautiful maiden. Then Kiyomo, recognising his sister, ran to embrace her, and in the presence of the king heard from her all the treacherous conduct of Trokola, and how the envy of that wicked creature had brought that fair fire of love to dwell in the waters of the sea. The joy of the king is not to be told of the acquisition of so fair a jewel, and turning to his brother, he said he had good reason to praise Matsuyala so much, and indeed he found her three times more beautiful than he had described her. He deemed her, therefore, more than worthy to be his wife, if she would be content to receive the sceptre of his kingdom. "Alas, would to heaven it would be so," answered Matsuyala, and that I could serve you as the slave of your crown. But see you not this golden chain upon my foot, by which the sorceress holds me prisoner? When I take too much fresh air, and tarry too long on the shore, she draws me into the waves, and thus keeps me by a golden chain. What way is there, said the king, to flee from the claws of this mermaid siren? The way, replied Marziella, would be to cut this chain with a smooth file, and to loose me from it. Wait till tomorrow morning, answered the king. I will then come with all that is needful, and take you home with me, where you will be the pupil of my eye, the core of my heart, and the life of my soul. And then, exchanging a shake of the hands as the earnest money of their love, she went back into the water, and he into the fire, and in such a fire indeed, that he had not an hour's rest the whole day long. And when the black old hag of the night came forth to have a country dance with the stars, he never closed an eye, but lay ruminating in his memory over the beauties of Marziella, discussing in the thoughts the marvels of her hair, the miracles of her mouth, and the wonders of her feet, and applying the gold of graces to the touchstone of judgment, he found it was 24 carats fine. But he upbraided the knight for not leaving off her embroidery of the stars, and chided the sun for not arriving with a chariot of light to enrich his house with the treasure he longed for, a mine of gold which produced pearls, a pearl shell from which sprang flowers. But whilst he was thus at sea, thinking of her who all the while was in the sea, behold, the pioneers of the sun appeared, who smoothed the road along which he has to pass with the army of his rays. Then the king dressed himself and went with Chiomel to the seashore, where he found Marziella, and the king, with his own hand, cut the chain from the foot of the beloved object with the file which they had brought, and all the while he forged a still stronger one for his heart, and setting her on the saddle behind him, she who was already fixed on the saddle of his heart, he set out for the royal palace, where by his command all the ladies of the land were assembled, who received Marziella as their mistress with all due honour, seeing her sweetness and kindness. Then the king married her, and there were great festivities, and among all the casks which were burnt for the illuminations, the king, who was not all sweetness and light, ordered that Trocola should be shut in a tub and made to suffer for the treachery she had shown to Marziella. Thus, then sending for Laquita, he gave her and Chiomo enough to live upon like princes, whilst Puccia, driven out of the kingdom, wandered about as a beggar, and the reward of her not having sown a little piece of pizza, she now had to suffer a constant want of pizza and bread. For it is said that he who shows no pity finds none. And that, gentle listener, is the end of my tale. And I hope it brought you pleasure, for it had no other purpose. If you're just here for the story, now is probably a good time to leave us. If you're interested in finding out where the story comes from, or what food we're going to be talking about and the recipe, then please stick with us. You'd be very welcome. As I mentioned before, this is another fantastic story from Giambattista Basile's Tale of Tales. I've already explored the history of these volumes in my Cat Cinderella episode, but here's a quick recap for anyone who missed it. This book is a set of tales within a frame story of a wronged bride. The volumes of the book were published between 1634 and 36, and predate the books of literary fairy tales from Charles Perrault in France and the Grimm brothers in Germany. There are definitely some arguments that state that the Grimm brothers were influenced by these stories, not just by the oral tales they collected. But that will have to wait for another time, when we have a lot more time. I'd also prefer not to be chased with flaming pitchforks by Grimm enthusiasts, so I will tread carefully. This tale combines a couple of story types identified by the Arne Thompson Index, that of the Kind and Unkind Girls, AT403, and the False Bride, AT480. We looked at the first briefly when we looked at the three heads in a well, and there are quite a few similarities. The kind and generous girl, Marziella, is rewarded for her actions, whereas the mean-spirited one, Puccia, in this case, cousins, not stepsisters, is punished for her unkindness and discourtesy. The original tale also has the outside appearance of the girls reflecting their inner personalities, to contrast with real life, where deceit and mean-spiritedness can often hide behind a beautiful face. Our societal standards are thankfully slowly changing, and I prefer to keep things closer to our reality and stress how it is the actions of the girls, not how they look originally, that drives the story forwards. It also explains how a brother could not recognise his sister if one girl was so beautiful and one was so unattractive. It's a tricky one for a storyteller to carry off. You'd expect two maternal cousins to at least bear a passing resemblance to one another. The original Tale of Tales was written in Neapolitan dialect, and the translations into English in 1847 and 1893 were not as good as they might have been, especially as it's quite difficult to capture the feel of the original dialect. There is a much better modern translation by Nancy Canepa in 2007, where the dialect is captured in a truer fashion. The Victorian translators were also held back by the moral standards of their time, where some of the less, shall we say, family-friendly content could not be shared in printed form. As a storyteller, we have the luxury of picking and choosing to a certain extent, trying to be as true to the feel of the story as possible. In the earlier translations, the birds that attended on the beach are geese, thus the link to the second story type, the grim false bride story of The Goose Girl. If you don't recall that one, it's the one with the talking horse, where the head of the horse keeps talking after it's dead and mounted over an archway, and the goose boy is forced to run all over hill and dale for his hat so he won't see the princess's beautiful hair unbound. Aren't fairy tales gloriously weird? In the newer and more accurate translation, these birds are ducks. It probably doesn't make that much difference, although you'd think ducks would be less valuable than geese, if only from a size perspective. It may also mean that Kiyomo's status is reduced even lower than we previously realised. No wonder he was so miserable and made such a bad keeper for the ducks. Although he obviously wasn't very super observant at any point, see the note above about recognising his own sister. The language, in both versions, is wonderfully flowery and dramatic, as befitted something that was written for court entertainment by someone who was a member of it. Basile wasn't really hiding his feelings about the duplicity and poor morals of the court here. The story clearly wants to highlight what you can achieve with courtesy and kindness and true family feeling, especially when you have a clever king who knows the difference between goodness and wickedness and deals with them appropriately. It's a thinly veiled truth here that it's not normal behaviour in a court setting. Basile was also determined to demonstrate that the punishments for the aunt and the cousin fit their crimes. You could argue that being blown up with the fireworks at the wedding of your niece, whom you tried to murder, is going a little bit far. You can't, however, argue with the style and panache. I have one more note on the translation that conveniently links both food and stories. If you go looking for this story in the public domain translations of the book, you won't find it by this title. It's known there as The Two Little Cakes, but the modern translation uses the title Two Little Pizzas, and the translation makes far more sense than the story. It also made me think of the best pizza I ever ate, garnished with parmesan and fresh rocket, sitting outside a restaurant in the hills around Rome, looking down on the city at sunset. There was also much ice-cold white wine made less than 2 kilometres away from the restaurant, which was also available in refillable containers from a small shop next door. In Frascati, it's bring your own food, not bring your own wine. Sorry about this small diversion, but I think I'm really starting to miss travelling. I've never been to Naples, but when we can, I want to go and try the pizza there and see if it's as good as that one outside Rome. And so, I'm sticking with the Two Little Pizza title. It might surprise you, now that I've whetted your mouth for perfect pizza, that I'm not going to mention it at all in the food section. The story offers so many other opportunities to explore full history. And I feel that if I start to research the history of pizza, it might go the same way as when I researched macaroni. None of us has time for that. Also, I found myself glaring at a packet of macaroni in the cupboard yesterday, and I don't want to fall out of love with pizza. So that left us with a choice of parsnips and green sauce, sweet almond cakes, or marzipan and rose water. Now, I'm a bigger fan of marzipan, but I don't think anyone over the age of 10 can consume lots. Also, I suspect many people are still picking off their leftover Christmas cake as I speak. It could be said that rose water is more of a perfume than a flavouring. I'm not one of them, but I think I'm in a minority. I also love parma violets, and I'm not even slightly ashamed. I love almond cakes more than anything, but I'm saving that recipe for a special occasion, so crispy fried parsnips and green sauce it is. It's hopefully more interesting as well as delicious than that makes it sound. Let's start with a parsnip. I would like for the record to state that my nan, Ivy, made the best roast parsnips ever. They were crisp and salty on the outside, yet meltingly soft and sweet inside. I can't recreate them. I've tried. I've parboiled them first. I've not parboiled them first. I've tried coating them in oil and then in a hot oven. I've preheated the oil in the oven. I've used olive oil, sunflower oil, goose fat and beef dripping. I've tried all of the oils and all of the methods in a variety of mind-boggling combinations. The closest I can come to is with hot beef dripping and parboiling. I'm missing something. They're really good. They're just not Nan perfect. I remember so much from my Nan through feed. But there was so much I never knew. I needed to ask. and it's been too late now for over 2 decades. Thankfully, Mum remembers quite a lot, so not all of it's lost, but I've recently realised that when I go, it will be. I don't have children, and my nieces and nephews aren't interested in cooking, and they don't remember Nan anyway, and that's a big part of why remembering is so important. Writing this, I've realised my brush with COVID over Christmas, although only a mild case, thankfully, has left me with more scars than I'd realised, but they obviously aren't the type you can see. I might have to go away after this and roast parsnips and eat them while I phone my mum so we can talk about her. While she still has us to talk about her, then she's still here. As Terry Pratchett says, a man is not dead while his name is still spoken. So, hopefully, if you make the recipe, you'll think kindly of an incredibly lovely woman called Ivy that you have never met. It might also help if you know that she made all of her own clothes on an antique sewing machine, was an incredibly skilled, demon-fast speed knitter, grew ridiculous amounts of runner beans every summer, and knew how to get the best produce from reluctant stallholders all over the markets of Birmingham and the Black Country. She also had the best stories, told exciting futures and tea leaves, and cooked wonderful meals on a shoestring budget in a kitchen that always felt like it had its arms wrapped around you. So, we'll go back to parsnips. They've fallen out of favour a lot now here, except for roast parsnips and the occasional spiced parsnip soup, sometimes with apple. Didn't used to be like that. They've been upstaged by cheap sugar and potatoes. They were once an important way to add sweetness and carbohydrate to a meal when potatoes hadn't even been heard of in Europe and sugar was like gold dust in cost and scarcity. Honey was also pretty pricey, so parsnips were useful and could often be used as the base of a sweet pudding as well as a savoury accompaniment. The name comes from the Latin pastinaca, but I should mention that the ancient writers didn't differentiate between parsnips and carrots. This isn't as odd as it sounds, as your ancient carrot had not yet achieved its splendid orange colour and was more often white or occasionally purple. According to Apicus, they were prized by the Romans and were later popular all over medieval Europe. They were used in puddings, as mentioned earlier, but were also mashed, fried, served as fritters and served sliced around meats. They were often a key ingredient in soups, stews and pottages. However, as cheap sugar and potatoes became available, their popularity waned, and they have virtually disappeared from southern and central Europe and are only marginally popular in the UK. It's been suggested that it's also down to the taste, which although mild, tends to pervade every dish where it's present. It's a bit like Marmite in that you either love it or hate it. It's also a vegetable that can take strong flavours, which leads us to the green sauce. Green sauce was incredibly popular all over medieval Europe and took its name from the green colour of the herbs that were its major ingredient, particularly sorrel. There was often garlic and salt and pepper, and sometimes fir juice added. In Italy, it often had similar ingredients, but more usually with vinegar added, similar to a salsa verde. It appears in many early recipe books, including Robert May's Accomplished Cook in 1660, but quite often as an instruction to prepare herbs, as you would for green sauce. This very much suggests that it was so widely used and known that no one was going to bother with a recipe for it. There is even a recipe for it, well-ish, in Gervase Markham's The English Housewife from 1631, as a sauce for chicken, although its name, green sauce, isn't specifically mentioned. It also appears in a French cookery book as early as 1300 and crops up in medieval cookbooks all over Europe for the 200-year period from that date. It was more so normally served with meat and fish, but definitely wouldn't be out of place with vegetables, especially on a day when meat couldn't be eaten. We still eat it today in the form of salsa verde and other green herb sauces with garlic and anchovy and capers. The recipe I'll be sharing, which cuts through the fat from the roast parsnips, also goes well with anything on the heavier side, which needs a last-minute burst of flavour, including lentils and sausages. It's great with fattier meats like lamb and pork, but would also work with goose. I've absolutely no idea what Ivy would have made of it, but she loved new things, so I'd like to think she would approve. As always, today's recipe can be found either directly on my blog, www.hessiaskitchen.co.uk, or you can find it in the show notes, where there'll be some other information about some of the sources that I've used, and also some of the cookery books, or at least links to them. I just have one short notice before I leave you today. I'm really enjoying making this podcast. I love the research, I love the stories. I really want to make sure it's a quality programme that you enjoy listening to. And I'm afraid in order to do that, I need to make this every 2 weeks instead of every week. I'm hoping to make the episodes slightly longer as well by having some interviews with people you might find interesting. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me in 2 weeks for another episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.